for me last week. And ironically, as we fled Florida because of the flood, we find ourselves in Genesis 6 tonight. Sometimes it just kind of works out that way. So let's pray together before we begin. God, as we go to your book and try to understand how you've revealed yourself from the beginning, we pray that you would help us understand you as you act with righteousness and bring judgment. In Jesus' name, amen. So, if I could throw back up here this chart we started with, the one I told you I ripped off from Jeff, the two great cycles of human history. While I was gone, we got another TV. Did y'all have that last week?
Yeah.
Did you? You didn't use it.
No, I did.
You did? Well, there you go. There you go. Well, so that's cool. Now you guys can not rinse your necks for the entire class. But if you remember those two cycles, Troy's still determined to look over his shoulder. I will try to gesture both directions. We're actually coming to the end of the first one, which is going to be significant because we are reaching a pivot point in the story of not just Genesis, but the story of man. And so tonight as we move to chapter 6, after sin has made its appearance and spread, we'll read more about that and its dramatic impact, and then we have judgment and or deliverance that will come in 7 and 8, and then we start over again. And we'll talk more about that when we get into class next week. So we're kind of still following that cycle. And then focusing in on this segment we're looking at, let me also sort of break that down into four pieces. I think when you look at the flood story, we open in chapter 6 with what I would call just setting the context. And we'll talk a little bit about what that's about. But I think the first 8 or 9 verses, I wrestled with my own division as I went back and studied some more this week. The first 8 or 9 verses give you context for what's coming. And then there's a lengthy segment that's just all about getting ready for the flood, right? The preparations. And then finally in chapter 7 and verse 6, the flood comes. And we're given some about that story. And then chapter 8 is entirely about the aftermath. And so what I'd like to do tonight is sort of walk through that, talk it about a little bit. And then we'll come back at the end and think about the bigger Bible story and how this contributes to that. I'm interested in what you thought you might have about that. And then we'll deal with one thing at the very end. I want to deal with the critic complaint that Moses is ripping off other ancient authors when he gives us the flood account here. I think probably the greatest, most frequent criticism you will hear of the flood story is that it isn't legit, that Moses is just ripping off a bunch of old flood stories that were around for a long time before him. So we'll talk about that too. Let's begin in chapter 6. I think I'm just going to read this segment because if you read this in advance, you know it's kind of loaded with interesting stuff, isn't it? So y'all don't go weird on me in this section, okay? Because there are some odd things. Let's read it together. Chapter 6, verse 1. Now it came about when man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to the birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. Now, this is where I don't know whether to throw in 9 with 8, because 9 says, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And the 9 said, these are the records of the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. Noah walked with God. And that just, the more I thought about it, it seemed to tuck nicely in with verse 8 as well. So, all kinds of bizarre stuff to ponder in these first 9 or 10 verses of chapter 6. I think what will help us make our way through this is if we remember what is Moses' primary point, what he's trying to tell us in this segment. Anyone want to take a shot at what that might be? That's a terrible way to ask a question, isn't it? It doesn't say, there's one right answer, let's see if you can get it, which is kind of what I'm saying. So what do you think? Yeah, I wouldn't want to jump on that either.
I'll take a shot.
Take a shot. Take a risk.
Well, of course, he's writing this as they came out of captivity, if you look at it from Moses' perspective, keeping themselves pure. I think you have here, and if you look back to 4 and 5, there's a line of Cain and a line of Seth. And it says, in the Seth's time, they called on the name of the Lord. So you have the faithful, the unfaithful, and they intermarry, and you get the corruption.
So let's think about how the corruption plays into what's coming. Does that make sense? What do you think? How does this help us for what's coming, which is the flood?
God couldn't take it anymore.
I think that the setup of these first 8 or 9 verses is to say that what God is about to do is justified. The point being made in the first 8 verses or so is that men were terribly evil. Wickedness had started with Adam and Eve, and then Cain and Abel, and then boom, the problem just blows up. We'll say a little bit more about the two lines in a minute. And so God now must, in his righteousness, act. And so I think it justifies, because listen, the flood is horrible, folks. It's we tell it to children in Bible class, and when you really get what's going on, you kind of wonder why. Right? God's about to, in fact, this will be a point of emphasis when we get later into chapter 7. God is about to wipe out every living thing. What warrants such a dramatic judgment? So I think the first 8 verses are really critical, because it's God saying, here's why. Men were horrifically corrupt. Yes, ma'am.
And up until this point, you know, with Adam and Eve, we have kind of an isolated incident that speaks to a larger problem, but it's one thing. And then with Cain and Abel, we have one thing. And so it would be easy to look at those two and say, well, I mean, everyone sins from time to time. And the first part of this chapter says, no, they sin a lot. And that's why God has to do this.
Well, so that actually segues into some of the kind of thorny sections of these first 8 verses. I think if you remember that what's happening here is God is fundamentally saying mankind became very, very evil, then that helps us kind of go back and interpret this other stuff that's going on. So if you back up to verse number one is sort of a connecting piece between the genealogies of chapters 4 and 5 and this new segment that's coming in 6, 7, and 8. Verse 1 says, now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, the daughters were born to them, and the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves. And for some reason, that feels like it was a bad thing, right? Do y'all get that sense too? I mean, it is the setup for this horrible judgment and this graphic description of man's wickedness. So why was it bad that the sons of God married the daughters of men? And I think you're right, Scott. I think that's looking backward. Do you remember the genealogies? We're given 2 genealogies in the 2 previous chapters. What are the 2 genealogies?
Abraham
This is on you, dude.
I put the question up on the screen. Back at, look at the video.
They got it. Oh, I was watching you on video. There was an hour difference, man. I was with you in class. Well, I wasn't texting in questions like John Parsons. Anyway.
Cain.
Okay, so you have the genealogy of Cain, the surviving first of the first two sons of Adam, and then you have the genealogy of Seth, the third son. And fundamentally, what's the difference between Cain and Seth?
One was better at serving God. The other didn't.
Yeah, one was good, generally speaking, and one was not good. And so when it talks about the sons of God intermarrying the daughters of man, I think it's talking about the blending of the two lines. It's saying that Seth's line, the godly line, intermarried with the wicked line, right? Cain's line. How does that work out? Almost all the time.
No.
Nobody wants to touch that? How does it work out when the good blend with the evil? Yeah, the evil typically carries the day, and they wind up being corrupted, which explains then why we get to verse 5, and he said, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth. What had happened? Well, you had good and bad, but then they blended, and that corrupted all of humanity. So the mixing of the two lines led to the corruption of man. Are you with me on that? And it is exceedingly bad. Every intent, the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. So, backing up to verse 3, I skipped that. God says, my spirit shall not strive forever with, shall not strive with man forever. What do you think that means? That was open-ended, not narrow.
Man's not going to live forever.
Man's not going to live forever. Good. What else?
Or like, she said, God's sick of it. He's tired of it. I'm not going to keep doing this. God's patience will run out.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if it's looking at that current circumstance and God is saying, okay, this can't continue. This can't continue to go on that way. In fact, there's a time figure mentioned in verse 3. What is it? 120 years. What is that?
Well, before this, they were living to be 800, 900 years old.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's also how long Moses lived.
Yeah.
Who's writing this?
So can I pitch something else to you to consider?
As long as we can live righteously.
I wonder if this is the timetable for the flood. I wonder if God is saying, I'm not going to strive with man forever. I'm going to deal with this, and it's going to be in about 120 years. I wonder about that. Consider the possibility. So the idea is that the lines mixed. Man became horrifically corrupt. God said, this can't go on forever. In fact, in a little over 100 years, I'm going to intervene, and I'm going to deal with this. So can we just skip the Nephilim and move on? Yes, sir.
There's a phrase at the end of chapter, verse 2, that says, when they married and took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. That seems to imply there was not a restriction that was adhered to. So, you know, and you read Cain's line, he had multiple wives, Lamech did.
Yeah.
So it sounds like they had gotten away from God's plan.
Yeah, I have wondered what to do with that, whomever they chose, because when I read that, it just echoes of some other passages that talk about men doing whatever they choose to do and how that doesn't work out very well. And so it makes me kind of wonder if maybe there had been admonition to Seth's line to, hey, don't be mixing with those folks, it's going to be good for you. That's certainly what God is going to tell Israel when they go into Canaan. Don't intermarry with those people, they will corrupt you. And that didn't work out well either, they didn't listen on that point. So I kind of wondered if maybe they had been warned not to do this along the way somewhere, and they did it anyway, and look what happened. So the Nephilim, some believe that the Nephilim are the offspring of these two lines. I don't agree with that view. The word Nephilim just means fallen ones. And I think it's just descriptive of the age and the time in which they're living. The people were fallen. They were rebels against God's will. And things were bad. So bad that God is grieved that he has made men. Now, what's the bright spot in that story?
Noah
is the bright spot. So we get to verse 8, but Noah found favor with God. And tell me why he found favor with God. Sorry? He walked with God. What else?
Righteous.
He was righteous. Yes, that's exactly right. So Noah becomes the foil to his generation. Whole generation of rebels. And here's this good guy who's leading his family to do the right thing. By the way, there's great foreshadowing there, but what's going to be the plight of the godly? Almost every age, the godly are the persecuted minority. And that's how it is for Noah. He's this one righteous holdout. And all the way through this segment, I want you to watch for it, he is contrasted with the wicked people of his day. Over and over again, we're reminded how they rebelled and how they had corrupted the earth. And yet, over and over again, we're reminded how Noah was faithful to the Lord. Okay, so what do you have on those first nine verses? Any other questions or issues there you want us to deal with?
So, just real quick, because I always get this question is, well, Noah was righteous, but what about the other seven that were saved? Were they righteous, or were they just subject to Noah's authority and whatever, and they were just lumped in with Noah?
So my view of that would be that they are righteous, and that's why they're saved on the ark. And the reason I believe that is because I also believe that Noah's family was far bigger than the eight saved on the ark. He's an old dude by this time,
yeah,
right?
We think that the families are small because we're thinking in our
20th century mindset. Yeah, Noah likely has great grandchildren by this point, right? And so the disturbing thing is that only eight of Noah's family wind up surviving this. Him and his wife and his sons and their wives. What about their children? Because, I mean, how old are Noah's kids at this point? I know, we think of, you know, like 17, right? No, they're married. No, 22. No, they're hundreds of years old. They had children. They had great-grandchildren. Where are they? Aren't they mentioned? So my guess is that these are the eight that were righteous. Text doesn't say that, but that would be my conclusion. I think you had your hand.
You could also look at it as God blessing his lineage, sort of like he did David, even though there were some corrupt kings in David's line, he did continue that line.
Yeah, and then the only question I have about that is, what about the other family members? And I don't have, and so to give some credence to that, the boys aren't going to behave later, right?
Okay.
But then again, neither does Noah. So who knows?
Yeah.
Good question. Yes, ma'am.
But obviously they had gotten to a point where there was nothing holding them back, and God said it stops.
Yes, and I think that's the thing that I want you to see at the opening of 6. I know we got all this stuff about sons of God and daughters of men and the Nephilim and what is the 120 years and all of that. I wouldn't be dogmatic about any of that. The big idea there is men were really, really wicked, and God said, I cannot endure that any longer. By the way, we should give some context to that. That's not like us getting fed up with our children when they have a day off from school. We just think, I can't take these kids anymore today, right?
But you cannot argue with
God. Hold on, that thought. This is about the justice of God saying, my just nature cannot permit this to continue without being punished. So it's the justice of God, not the rage of God, that is working. I'm sorry, go ahead and finish that.
Nobody could argue that God had the authority, and he did it.
Correct.
And they died.
Correct. Yes, that's right. Okay, yes, sir. Last word.
I was going to say, in reference to Noah's family, if God's going to go this effort to basically destroy the earth and all the living creatures in it, and unlike you, I thought Noah probably had this large family. the remnant that was there, the ones that believed and were faithful. Otherwise, he would have taken them too. Why go to all the effort? Now we'll let five speak in.
Yeah.
We'll let some of the back.
Yeah. That's the best question I can muster, or best answer I can muster to the question. Okay, segment two then turns us to the preparation. So after we kind of get the setting, the context for what God's about to do, then they begin the process of building. I see two segments here as well. If you look down in 6 and verse 14, God gives him two commands. The first one is, build an ark. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. And then the second command is in 7:1. What's the command there? You see it?
Get in it.
Get in it. Which makes me actually, and we'd have to ask Jeff if this is legit, but it makes me think of the creation story. Remember, God builds things and then he fills things, right? Well, once again, God has built something, or has Noah build it, and then he fills it with Noah's family. And so those are kind of the two segments of this. Now, in each of those segments, there is some repetition. For example, did you notice that we're told a couple of times about taking the animals by two? Wasn't that interesting? So why the repetition?
That's the way to continue.
Sorry?
That's the way to continue with nature.
Oh, well, okay, but why tell us twice that he's taking them by two?
It's a literary tool that's used in writing that to emphasize certain points to get across to the reader.
Yeah.
Yeah, to make a point.
Yeah, and notice, like with Genesis 1 and 2, the second time the story is told, it's not told exactly the same way. Not that it's a different story, but it's a fuller story. We're given more details. The second time we're told about the animals, we said, yes, they took them by twos, but what else?
Seven.
Yeah, and the clean animals by seven. And so.
Is that seven pair or seven?
I have no position on that. I've actually got that written in my notes. That can either be seven pair or seven individual. And I really hate the uneven number if it's seven pair or.
It has to be seven.
It'd be 14.
They have to go two by two. They can't go two by two.
By the way, we get a little hint about what that's about later, don't we, in chapter 8? What do they do with the clean animals later?
Sacrifice.
Yeah, yeah. That became important that, sadly, you know, they didn't kill off all the cats as soon as they got them off the ark, which would have been.
Stop.
Did I say that? I need to edit the tape on that. So anyway, it's interesting that we do have some repetition with that. The other thing that I find interesting about the preparation segment is how very specific it is. Did y'all notice that? Like, what kind of detail does the prep segment give us? Yeah, I know.
Like
what?
Three levels, number one. Exact number of,
yeah, there are construction details about the number of decks on the ship.
Windows.
He talks about windows, where the windows need to go, and the door.
How to seal it.
The seal.
Exact wood to use.
He tells them what kind of wood to use. You go to Lowe's, get the cheap pine. I want you to get the gopher, whatever that is, the gopher wood. And what's odd to me about that is the whole creation story is told in one chapter, and it's not even like an Isaiah long chapter. It's just an ordinary chapter in Genesis chapter 1. And so typically the Bible is very concise, but all of a sudden when we're doing the Noah story, well, actually, did you bring up the tabernacle? Was that you that
said
that?
Yes, I just said tabernacle.
Somebody said tabernacle.
Details.
It's very much like what you encounter later in Exodus where Moses is given instructions about building the tabernacle. So, let me pitch this out to you. Why do you think we're given all that detail? All the details about how it's to be built.
Well, Noah had to have the
detail. But we don't. I'm sure there's a lot more that God told him that perhaps we don't.
Does that not exemplify his righteousness and that he followed step by step, detail by detail, what God told him to do.
So this is
all that God commanded.
So we all noticed that with me. That is a redundant device all the way through. And by the way, remember, because the Bible is typically very concise, anytime something is sort of unpacked for us, pay attention. It's probably got some significance to it. And Troy, that was exactly my thought about this, that maybe God gives us all this detail because he wants to play off of it to show us Noah's obedience. So going back up to chapter 6 and verse 9, remember, he walked with God. Now go down to 6 and 22. We get this first record of what he was supposed to do, collect the animals and how and put them in the ark. What does verse 22 tell us?
He did all that he commanded.
Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. And then you get this second at the beginning of 7, where we kind of have the redundancy and we're told more about the ones that would be taken by 7, more animals and all of that. And you get to verse 5 and what are we told?
Same thing.
Noah did according to all that the Lord had commanded him. So I wonder if the detail is given because God is trying to play up his obedience. By the way, when you get to Exodus and they're building the tabernacle, you have exactly the same thing, the same redundant device. Over and over again, we're told how Moses obeyed God right down to the last detail. He built it like God said to build it. And it's the same kind of thing where all this detail about, you know, it's going to be this long and this wide and this high, these curtains and these furniture, all that detail is there. And I think it plays up the obedience. Who had their hand up?
I had. It just tells us we need to follow direction. I mean, that's our life. You know, in everything that we do, and that's one thing that we work even to teach our kids or whatever is, you know, that stop sign's there for a purpose. The directions that the doctor gave you, that's for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And so that's one of the best examples right there.
I agree. And I think one of the things that should make us cautious about is being dismissive about things in the text that we decide are details. I just think we need to be careful about that because I think there are folks who are inclined to look at things in the Bible today and say, oh, surely God isn't serious about that. Have you ever had that conversation with people? They look at something in the Bible and say, oh, surely God wasn't serious about baptism.
He didn't mean that.
Yeah, yeah. And I just think we got to be careful about that because remember that Genesis is giving us these two contrasting pathways. There's the path that the world has taken with the blending of the lines that has corrupted the world. They're not walking with God. And then you have this guy out here who is way in the minority, who's building a boat because a flood's coming. How nutty must that have been to everybody? And he's the guy who's doing what God said to do. So a whole lot of great practical lessons wrapped up in that. Yes, ma'am.
And if we go with the theory that Moses is writing this during the Exodus, this feels like the way that I deal with my kids when one of them is having a good day and one is having a bad day. Why can't you do like, look, your sister did a great job obeying me and doing what I told her to do. Wasn't that a wonderful thing for that this suddenly takes on new significance if Moses is writing this while he's out wandering around in the desert with a bunch of people who couldn't do what God told him to?
Or building the tabernacle. Interesting. Interesting.
And
yes, please.
In the same direction, another place where you see the same device is Leviticus 8 and 9, where everybody stops with reading through the Bible in a year.
Oh, yes. It's Leviticus. Leviticus is the read the Bible in a year plan killer, right?
Yes. And Leviticus 8 and 9 is really tedious.
Yes.
It's dozens of times. It's this really long, drawn-out explanation of how they consecrate the priests. And Moses did this, just as the Lord commanded him, dozens of times.
Over and over again.
But where it ends is in Leviticus 10, where it says that Nadab and Abihu offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And there we have the first example of somebody thinking the details aren't important.
Yeah, exactly. And how did that work out for them?
Hotly.
Yes. So One other thing while we're in this segment on preparations, it actually gives us a chance to talk about one of the objections that critics have to Genesis, and particularly this story, and that is what I would just label logistical objections. So surely you've had somebody come along and say something like, we know that story is true because there's no way you get all the animals on the ark, right? And even if you could all get all the animals on the ark, what about the food? I mean, what would you do with the food? How would you keep them fed all the time, right? And what about like pythons, you know? How are you going to deal with the pythons? How do you know they're not going to eat children? Well, there weren't children on the ark, so that wouldn't work anyway. And then, of course, what would have been the greatest issue to me is the problem of ventilation. Because you have animals and they're eating, right? I can't do a cat box in the house. I don't want to be on a boat full of animals. Yeah, enough said, without ventilation. So these are the kinds of things that critics argue to say the story isn't true. Logistically, it just wouldn't work. And so what would you say to that? Yes?
Again, if you go to verse 20, it says, at the end, two of every kind shall come to you, keep them alive. Now, I don't know if that's a translation thing, but it sounds like Moses or Noah didn't have to go out and capture these animals. They came to.
Yeah, that's another question people raise. How did he ever go capture all of the animals? How did he ever do that?
Yeah. So there's providence involved.
So I think that there are some things that can explain how the animals were kept on the ark. Hibernation, I think, is a way to explain how animals were kept on the ark. I think sometimes we don't open ourselves to the possibility that God categorized animals differently. I think you could have taken two cats and not one of each variety. I would have taken no cats. So, but I'm sorry if y'all love cats. I don't. And it's just a good opportunity to say things about it. And anyway, I think maybe the categories are a little different. But I think we're missing the forest for the trees on this.
Yes.
Which is? You know where I'm going?
This is God's plan.
You can do whatever you want.
Yes. Let me remind you what I said at the beginning. The big miracle is Genesis 1:1, okay? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If God can do that, God can figure out how to get the animals he wants on the boat, okay? Mm-hmm. And feed the animals and deal with ventilation issues, okay? God can take care of all of that. I marvel that people quibble over this. Quibble over Genesis 1, and if you have a problem, it needs to be with God making everything. But to say that the God who can speak everything into existence said, oh my, the boat needed to be 10 feet bigger, I don't know what I was thinking. You know, come on, I can work that out. That doesn't even break a sweat in the morning. Yes, sir, please.
If you can't believe this, and you can't believe the resurrection, can't believe in Samuel showing up to Saul.
Right.
And all that.
Yes. I think the tough miracle is the first one. And if that one is true, we can have absolute confidence in the rest of it. Okay? So I would not even fret over, and I know some brothers who spend copious amounts of their time figuring out ark logistics. And I think it's a process that ultimately is flawed because, anybody have any idea?
It's God's ark.
It's God's ark. And Genesis 6 was not written to help us answer the critics that the ark wouldn't work logistically. It had a whole different agenda that it was working. And so for us to go back there and try to figure it all out, I think God's looking down and saying, you don't need to worry about that. I can figure that out. You just need to trust me. That's the point. Yes?
Not only that, but he was building it where there's no water.
Oh, I know. Noah must have been a freak. Come on, we just got to own that. Noah, I tell you, you hear Jeff and I talk frequently about fundamental changes in cultural worldviews that are taking place. That you and I are growing up at a time that is unlike any other time in recent memory in this country. And in fact, Jeff will say that the period we lived through, where by and large most people kind of saw the world the way we did, there's a God, the Bible is Word, Jesus is the Savior, and there's heaven or hell at the end, you know, that's been an exceptional period. And then we're really kind of sliding back into what is real, stuff that looks more like this. We need to look at Noah. He's our guy. The guy who will listen to God and who will believe the thing and do the thing that everyone else thinks is nuts. And I promise you, that is the age we're coming into. When the idea that you would believe a story like this, culturally, people will say is crazy. And yet we need to be like Noah, who walked with the Lord. Questions about that? Flood itself appears to have lasted a little over a year. There are some time markers given, which I think are significant. To me, that bears the mark of authenticity. You know what I mean when I say that? It doesn't sound like a mythical story used for illustration, not when you have time marking. So what I mean by that is if you look at chapter 7 and verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of that month, on that same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open and the floodgates of the sky were open. So the flood started at that time. And then if you jump ahead to chapter 8, and now I'm looking down at verse 13. Now it came about in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first of the month, the water dried up. Verse 14, in the second month, on the 24th day of the month, the earth was dry. So I think it is curious that we're given these specific time figures, which to me bear the marks of a true story. And if that's, if I'm reading that correctly, what that means is that the flood from beginning to end is roughly a year-long event. It's a long time to be on that boat with those animals.
It also implies that it wasn't local.
No, could not have been local, right? In fact, if there's something to highlight in this next segment, this would be from 7 and verse 6 through the end of chapter 7. The thing to highlight, I think, is beginning at verse 21. This is 7:21. All flesh that moved on the earth perished. Birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth and all mankind. Of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, died. Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the earth, from man to animal to creeping thing, to the birds of the sky, and they were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left, together with those that were with him in the ark. That's the point of it. Every living thing died. Now, if you go back, let me see if I can back this up. If you go back to our two cycles, what's going to happen after the flood? Begins the next cycle. You start over. You're back to beginning conditions. And so I think one of the reasons for the emphasis there is we are completely starting over. It's beginning again. It's back to the startup, essentially, the startup conditions that you begin with in Genesis chapter 1. See that?
Not as nice.
What's that?
I mean, they had no vegetation, right? They would have been destroyed in the flood.
Everything, yeah. Underwater for
no trees,
for a year.
Yeah. Well, something started growing because he until we got the olive branch.
Well, remember, just they didn't get off the ark when the water receded. We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. And how long did it say? There's a passage here. I was reading it this afternoon. 100 days? Where's the 100 days? Where? What verse is that?
7:20.
Oh, yeah, thank you. It was the very next verse. I just should have read on. The water prevailed on the earth for 150 days. Now, if the flood lasted a year, there's your time for regeneration to begin. We'll get to that in a second. But did I miss a question? Yeah.
Why did the sea monsters get a pass? I don't get that.
You lost
God
me.
God created sea monsters in chapter 1, verse 20.
Yeah.
Why? This is probably a question in the car on the way home, but.
I'm really feeling that.
Everything died that breathed. Of course, fish don't breathe. Why'd they get a pass? I guess someone had to. Maybe they had to have food when they got out. I don't know.
So one of the things I've always assumed is that fish were not preserved on the ark.
No, right.
They had aquariums.
They were already in the water.
What's that?
They were already in the water.
Yeah. So
we gotta catch. We washed.
Okay, so first of all, I don't have a biblical answer for you about that, but my guess is that sea life survived the flood.
Yes.
I'm not sure how a flood would kill animals that lived in the water. That would be my guess.
Would they say killed everything with the breath of life?
Yeah, with the breath of life. Yes. Yeah. Distinguishing that from sea creatures, yeah. That would be my gut about that. Any other questions about flood? Yes?
I was going to make a statement. The Chinese symbol for boat is eight people in a vessel.
Interesting.
It's a combination of two characters of eight people and
it's a symbol for flood. Symbol for flood is boat and eight.
Yeah.
Interesting. By the way, would critics say there are other flood stories from ancient times?
Yes.
Yes, there are.
It's true.
Every culture.
It's true. That's flood stories. Interesting. Hold that thought. Because I want to talk a little bit about the aftermath. Let me advance my slide back to where it was. Because that's chapter 8. And again, I see two segments in chapter 8. The first segment I would just call waiting, because there is a whole part of the story about them waiting. And then the other segment is about worship, which is what they do when they exit. So let's talk about the waiting period. 8 in verse 1 strikes me sort of like Genesis 1:1. It's just sort of this general statement, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were within the ark, and God caused the wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. So that's sort of a big picture. Now the flood is coming to an end. But then what follows is sort of the process by which that happens. So the first thing in verse 2 that happens is what? You see it there? Sorry?
I was looking at he caused the wind.
Yes, that's 1. In 8:2,
the rain
stops. Because in order for the floods to survive, to subside, it's got to stop raining. As we all learned with Harvey, right? Yes, it rained 10 inches on Monday, but the problem was, it rained 10 inches on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. That's why the waters didn't subside. They kept going up. So for the flood to stop, the rain has to stop. And then what happens in 8:3?
Slowly receded.
Sorry?
Slowly receded.
Yeah, the waters begin to subside. And then in 8:4?
The ark rested on a mountain.
The ark hits something. So they've gotten low enough now where they're contacting ground, and then by the time you get to 8:5, the mountains become visible. And then after 40 days, Noah does something really interesting. What is it? Surely you ladies know this, because you have taught it to your little kids in Bible class. He does the whole bird testing thing, right? Which I have to tell you is such a mystery to me. Because Moses devotes a lot of time to the back and forth with the birds. By the way, what is it that Noah is trying to figure out with the birds?
Safe to come out.
Is the land ready to receive us? Now, I can understand eagerness to get off the boat with the animals. I don't even like going to the zoo. I would want to get off the boat too. Why is it odd, or do you find it odd, that he's personally conducting these tests to figure this out? Why is it odd?
Well, God,
why didn't God just tell him it's time to go?
Everything else in the whole story has been at God's cue. And by the way, even after his test, does he leave? When does he leave? He waits, yeah, it's a win. Sorry? So if you look ahead in 8, look at verse 15.
When
God spoke to Noah, say, get out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons, and your sons' wives with you, and bring out every living thing. So again, he doesn't leave until God tells him to, which makes you then go back and say, so what was the thing with the birds?
Is it symbolic because one was a raven and one was a dove? And
And so if you're going to work the symbolism there, let's hear it. I'm curious.
No, I'm asking.
Okay, so I'll lead off by saying, I don't know.
Because there's two different birds.
I have puzzled over this. And, okay, so it's one of those things where you say, well, is there something deeper going on here? So y'all will not realize this, but there was actually, before y'all got here this afternoon, a preacher conference right at that door discussing the question of the birds. And no one had a good answer for why Noah tests with the birds. So just know in advance that we're hoping you guys know what that's about. Because I'm intrigued by it, and I'm not sure I do know what it was about. You want to take a shot at that, Bastard?
Since it's impromptu. If I had to guess, I would say that it probably has to do with indicating Noah's impatience. He knows he's not supposed to leave yet, but he's trying to get signs anyway.
Yeah.
And yet at the end, he doesn't leave until God tells him to.
Yes. Maybe so. Jeff thinks it's about starting over again with birds and fish, just like you have in Genesis. I'm not sure I bought that, but it was an interesting answer.
Well, throw a fish off the ark.
It's just human nature to be, you know, he's been on this ark for a long time. He's just curious about, you know, how are things out there? I wonder what's growing, what's happening.
Yeah.
So when he sends out the bird and she comes back with the branch, then he knows, okay, things are starting to grow. You know, it's just, it's
so maybe how big was the temptation to slap that door open and go down and see, though, when that bird came back?
My goodness, yes. Oh, yes. Or just open it for breathing purposes. If y'all can't tell, ventilation on the ark is a big deal to me.
He did open it, though.
Lots of questions about it. Yeah.
He may not could open the door. It said God shut it.
Yes.
I don't know that he could open it from it. Maybe he was just seeing, I think he was just seeing, is it getting close, you know, like the kids in the back seat of the car? Are we there yet?
I'll be there.
Is it getting close?
It's interesting.
Is the incoming here?
Yeah.
You know, how close are we?
The other possibility I would invite you to consider is what's going to happen after recreation.
Sin again.
And who's going to be involved in the sin? Noah is. So maybe already this is an early sign of even the good guy having times where he goes his own ways. Maybe this is hinting at something bigger to come. The attention devoted to it tugs at me to see more than just, hey, I think I'll send the birds out to see if the land's ready for us. Something to ponder. The other part after the waiting is they get off the ark and the very first thing they do is what? And
offer sacrifice.
Kill the animals they carried around all this time.
Some of them, not all of them.
Talk to me a little bit about that. Why do you think they did that?
Well, they were showing their gratitude for being saved.
Okay, so that's the word I was looking for. I think the act of worship here is all about gratitude.
Isn't the act of worship always about gratitude?
Not always. Sometimes it's celebration. But in this case, I think they are grateful to be counted among the survivors. And acts of worship always spring from that kind of a heart. Grateful to God for what he's done for us. Before I'm out of time, I really don't want to fail to comment on the Moses stole the story argument made by critics of the Bible. Let me just say that I think that is prime territory to just turn the argument right back around. Critics say, well, of course Moses has a flood story. All the ancient cultures have a flood story. Moses comes later, which he does and he doesn't. That just depends on how you view his writings. But Moses comes later, so surely he just stole the story from someone else. First of all, that's made up out of pulled out of the air. There's no evidence that Moses ripped off the story. However, It is curious that cultures throughout the world have ancient flood stories.
So they just all made them up too.
Well, it does beg the question. Forget about Moses for a minute and where he got his. If cultures all over the world essentially have a story that sounds alike, I would suggest that isn't a myth. I think it's more likely what?
History.
Maybe underneath the very, and there are different stories, but maybe underneath that is the fact there really was a flood, and cultures down through time wrote about it. And maybe it was embellished and changed. We know how stories get changed down through time, and maybe what God has Moses do is come back and give this story as it happened. Something to consider. I actually think that's not an argument against the story being true. I think it argues that the story is true. So for next class, the problem is going to spread. We're going to do 9, 10, and 11 and talk about the Tower of Babel. And that'll bring us to an end of these first 11 great chapters. Thank you.